Hello, I'm Angela, and welcome to this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News for the 20th of May 2026.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by the sight loss charity Beacon. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. Once you've enabled the Talking Newspapers skill, all you need to do is play Talking Newspapers and ask for the Black Country Talking News. Our Talking News service is also available via the free Wireless for the Blind app. It can be found on the Beacon Centre website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news. As a podcast via services such as Apple or Spotify, or as a free CD, simply contact Beacon Centre on 01902 880 111. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Reading for you this week, we have me, Angela, Matthew, Mohammed, Helen, Mina, Simon, and of course, not forgetting Roger. In this week's edition, we have all the latest from Beacon with Helen and Mohammed. We have some fascinating news and nostalgia from across the Black Country. Nestle down and find your comfy spot, as with thanks to TNF Soundings, we introduce episode 2 of Beyond the Core, an exclusive 3-part short story about a visually impaired military veteran, written especially for the Talking News by published author Chris Crowther. You'll have to be nimble-minded, as we have the latest number puzzle challenge from Roger and Mina. We park the dissection of Wolves relegation to one side and swing our way across the Atlantic to report on a spectacular and historic sporting achievement from last weekend and a journey that began right here in the Black Country. We hear from Mina, who has the forecast for the week ahead. And with the UK's living costs continuing to spiral, we introduce the final episode of an exclusive 6-part series providing further insight into a lifeline service, Black Country Food Bank, from the initiatives and projects through to interviews with the team of volunteers. Local news to start though with me, Angela and Matthew. A series of events are taking place over the next few days as Wolverhampton marks Dementia Action Week 2026, which began this Monday, the 18th of May. Dementia has a major impact affecting nearly a million people in the UK, including around 3,100 in Wolverhampton. Dementia does not just have a devastating effect on the individual, but also their families and friends, with an estimated 500,000 people in England providing primary care for someone living with dementia. Dementia Action Week, organised by the Alzheimer's Society and supported by the Wolverhampton Dementia Action Alliance and the City of Wolverhampton Council, is an opportunity to raise awareness of the help and support available to people living with dementia and their families and carers. This year also marks the launch of the Wolverhampton Integrated Dementia Strategy, which aims to improve the lives of people living with dementia and their families and carers in the city. In common with the strategy, this year's Dementia Action Week focuses on the importance of increased understanding, reducing stigma, and improving diagnosis rates. A number of events are taking place during Dementia Action Week, including the Council's Public Protection Team offering information and advice at a drop-in session at Bilston Indoor Market on Thursday the 21st of May from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Meanwhile, the University of Wolverhampton is launching Involve D Study, a nationally supported project reviewing an approach to working collaboratively with people from South Asian, Black African and African Caribbean communities in Wolverhampton to understand what supports them to live well with dementia in the places they live. For more details, please email k.jutla, that's J-U-T-L-L-A, at wlv.ac.uk. John Crockett, Chair of Wolverhampton Dementia Action Alliance, said, Dementia Action Week is showing once again the range of organisations across the city who are working together to make a difference for those people living with dementia, their families and carers. I'm so pleased that so many across Wolverhampton are taking the opportunity to help people to understand more about dementia and what they can do to help people living with dementia. It is estimated that one in three people born in the UK today will be diagnosed with dementia in their lifetime, and it remains the commitment of everyone in the Dementia Action Alliance to make Wolverhampton a dementia-friendly city. Dementia Action Week gives us the opportunity to showcase the many organisations who are working hard to make that ambition a reality. People who are worried about dementia can contact the Alzheimer's Society for information and support, either via the National Dementia Helpline on 0333 150 3456 or by visiting Alzheimer's Society. For more information about the help and support available locally, please visit Dementia. Hurst Hill Wood has been sold at auction for £90,000, leading to fears from locals regarding its future. The 11.5-acre parcel of land lying to the north of Turles Hill Road was sold on May the 14th at Bond Wharf Auctions, exactly £40,000 over its asking price of £50,000. Whilst the buyer as of yet remains unknown, the sale has raised fears over the future of the land from locals, many of whom had used the land for school trips, biking, foraging, or just simply walking. Hurst Hill Woods is a local nature reserve and former limestone quarry located on the border between Sedgley and Coesley in the Black Country. Situated just east of Sedgley Beacon, the woodland sits along the Turles Hill Valley. The land between Coesley and Sedgley features a notable local geographical dip or hollow, often referred to as the bowl. At auction, the description read, "The site, which is south of the area known locally as Hurst Hill Woods, may have development potential for a variety of uses, subject to planning permission." Expressing their fears over the site, Facebook user Iris Trustin wrote, "Hurst Hill means wood on a hill. Our house backed onto allotments, then onto the woods. We spent all our school holidays and weekends playing in the woods. We saw the first wood anemones, followed by cowslips, then bluebells growing. The foxes lived in the cave and used to sit on the wall of our garden at night. The owl used to sit on the tree outside my bedroom window every night. We all spent our childhood there. I can't imagine it being any different. Times move on, but not always for the better." Whilst many people are expressing their concerns online, others are taking the chance to share their loved memories of the land, including one person who spent the summers camping and bike riding. Richard Hawkins wrote, "Spent more of the school holidays down there making camps and on bikes. It was great outdoor fun." Kelly Smith added, "Spent most of my childhood over there. Let's hope whoever buys it doesn't rip it all down to build houses." It is unknown yet as to the future of the land. However, the Bond Wharf website described the land as having development potential, subject to proper planning consent. The description reads, "The site may be suitable for a variety of uses, subject to obtaining the necessary planning consents. All interested parties must make their own inquiries with Dudley Metropolitan Borough Council and satisfy themselves as to any use they may propose."
Up next, we have the Beacon Update, brought to us by Mohammed.
Hey everyone, it's Mo from Beacon here. And here's all the latest news and updates from across the charity. We've got plenty to be cracking on with this week, so let's get started. First up, if you're looking for something fun for the kids to do over half term, Beacon's got you covered with a free inclusive mixed sports session coming up on Tuesday the 26th of May from 10:30 till midday at Beacon Centre for the Blind in Sedgley. This session is open to children and young people of all disabilities and will include fun sports and some games in a fun and supportive environment delivered alongside our friends from the Wolves Foundation. It's a really nice opportunity for young people to get involved, try something new, and have a good time together during the holidays. If you'd like to book a place for your child or young person, give us a call on 01902 880111 or email us at inquiries@beaconvision.org. And while we're talking about events for young people and their families, don't forget that Beacon's Children and Young People Vision Support event is taking place on Thursday the 28th of May from 10 o'clock until 3. The event will give families a chance to get advice and support, explore equipment and technology, and find out more about the services and activities available for children and young people living with sight loss. It'll also be a great chance to meet other families and share experiences in a relaxed and welcoming environment. Now, over in our Lifestyle Centre, members recently enjoyed a lovely afternoon thanks to local singer Beth Tudor, who came in and performed an acoustic set for everybody. There was plenty of singing along, clapping and dancing, and you can see just how much everybody enjoyed it. A huge thank you to Beth for giving up her time and helping to create such a special and warm atmosphere for our members. Talking of amazing support, we'd also like to say a massive thank you and well done to our event photographer, Nathan Stiles, who recently took on and completed the Great Birmingham Run 10K in support of Beacon. Nathan is the one usually behind the camera capturing all the special moments at all of our events. So it's been brilliant to see him take on a challenge himself to raise money for people living with sight loss across the Black Country. He's already raised an incredible £465. So a huge thank you to Nathan and everybody who has supported him so far. And what a fantastic turnout we had at this year's Colour Run. It was brilliant seeing so many people come together, having fun and getting covered completely in colour while raising support for Beacon Centre for the Blind. A big thank you goes to all of our volunteers, supporters, friends from Park Run and the Mayor of Wolverhampton for helping make this event such a success. And a special shout out to local actor Rupi Lal for being an incredible event host. And last week was Mental Health Awareness Week. And this year's theme was action. Beacon used the week to highlight the importance of kindness, connection, and simply being there for one another, especially for people living with sight loss, who can sometimes feel isolated or lonely. Our telephone befriending service continues to make a vital difference, with friendly conversations and regular check-ins helping people to feel connected and supported. Sometimes just a small amount of time and a simple chat can completely brighten someone's day. So if you'd like to help make a difference and become a telephone befriender, Beacon would love to hear from you. And before we finish, here's a quick look at this week's community activities. On Wednesday, the 20th of May, there is a fishing trip. On Thursday, the 21st, a visit to the garden centre, and Friday sees us rounding off things nicely with a bowling activity. As always, all activities are designed to be accessible, welcoming, and supportive for people living with sight loss. And finally, don't forget Beacon's charity quiz night and live match screening hosted by local actor Rupi Lau, which promises to be a very fun evening for families and friends with quiz rounds for everyone to enjoy alongside the screening of the opening match between Mexico and South Africa. You can enter as a team of six or book individually and we'll assign a friendly team for you to join. The event takes place on the 11th of June, so book your tickets at buyyourtickets.beacon. And you can also find the event details on beaconvision.org. That's all from me this week. Take care, everyone, and I'll be here again next week with the latest news from across Beacon. But until then, goodbye.
Thanks for that update, Mohammed. Next up, we have another block of local news.
This week, we put the dissection of Wolves' relegation on hold to celebrate a truly spectacular sporting achievement from last weekend. History has been made at the newly renamed Aronimink Golf Club, with a stunning performance from Aaron Rye, making him only the eighth Englishman since 1940 to win a major and the first Englishman to win the Wanamaker Trophy since Jim Barnes 107 years ago in 1919. It feels fitting that an underdog who uses what some consider unorthodox methods was last man standing at a slugfest of a US PGA Championship held in Rocky Bilbao's backyard. While Wolverhampton-born Aaron Rye waited for his arms to be held aloft in Philadelphia as a first-time major champion, the 31-year-old Englishman could hear Eye of the Tiger, the unmistakable theme tune written for Rocky III, playing in the background as he received congratulations in the Aronimink clubhouse. Aaron doesn't punch hanging slabs of meat with his bare knuckles while training like the iconic boxing character. He's rarely bare-knuckled on the golf course. Unusually, Rye wears two gloves instead of the one which virtually everyone else across the world, professional and amateurs alike, wears for enhanced grip. "I just happened to be given two gloves and I got into the habit of wearing them," Aaron said of his early forays into the game. "Then, a few weeks down the line, my dad forgot to put the two gloves in the bag, so I had to play with one. It was terrible. I couldn't play. I couldn't feel the grip, so I've always stuck with the two gloves ever since." The quirky look is only one part of what makes Aaron Rye's fascinating journey from Village Purton, Wolverhampton, to the summit of the golfing world different. In fact, it was only by accident, and literally because of one, that Aaron took golf up at all. Playing with his older brother's hockey sticks as a toddler ended in Aaron copping a nasty bruise on his head, leading to Mother Dalvia heading to the shops for plastic versions, which she thought would be safer. Instead, she came back with plastic golf clubs and changed the course of her son's life. Aaron harbored hopes of becoming a Formula One driver as a youngster, but it was an idea which was quickly overtaken. "I used to love watching seven-time world champion Michael Schumacher, and it ran so deep that in junior golf competitions, I wore Ferrari t-shirts and jumpers," Rye told BBC Sport in 2018. "That was my thing even from a young age, but since 8 or 9, it became very quickly just about golf." A former Purton Primary School and Wolverhampton Grammar School pupil, Rye set a Guinness World Record age 15 for holing 207 consecutive 10-foot putts and went on to represent Shropshire and Herefordshire as a junior before going on to turn professional. But his ability became apparent as soon as he started regularly going to the Three Hammers Golf Complex in Wolverhampton at the age of 4. Aaron's father, Amrik, used to take him to Three Hammers for lessons with instructor Darren Prosser, with the youngster going out on the par 3 golf course afterwards to put what he had been taught into practice. Aaron already possessed a rare tunnel vision focus, a trait which enabled him to secure victory at Aaronimink for a player so callow, says Prosser. By the age of 10, Rye was coached by Andrew Proudman, who also worked in the Three Hammers Pro Shop, in tandem with another Wolverhampton pro, Piers Ward, and the pair still guide Rye to this day. When Prosser's path crossed with Rye again several years later at an Open Championship regional qualifier in Coventry, he realised the teenager had rapidly developed into a potential tour prospect. "I hardly recognised him," Prosser told BBC Radio 5 Live. "In such a short time, he'd shot up and he really was a strong guy. He was right on it, physically and mentally, and you thought then he was ready to go professional." Rye held the impact of his mentors, Proudman and Ward, in his post-victory news conference at Aaronimink. But the most gratitude goes eternally to his parents for their sacrifices in helping him reach the pinnacle of his chosen career. An emotional Aaron said it was hard to express everything they mean to him. Amrik quit his job to devote more time to raise development on the course, with Dalvia, who is of Kenyan Indian descent, working long hours to support things financially. "I can't put into words how much they've done in terms of the support, in terms of the care, in terms of love. I wouldn't be here without them at all," said Rye. Very few British Asians have played golf at the highest level, and again speaking to BBC Sport in 2018, Aaron said pursuing the game professionally might not always have been met with encouragement from some parents of Indian descent. But he said his folks always encouraged him to pursue his dream, especially his father, who turned down a tennis scholarship in the US at the age of 20. "Being from an Indian family was different back in those days," said Rye, who turned professional in 2012. "It was more about getting an education and a proper job. And sport or tennis at that time was never really seen as a proper job. That pressure to have certain kinds of career was probably there from the previous generation, and certain career paths in our culture are still more walked upon." Aaron credited the technical and mental advice provided by his wife, Gaurika Bishnoi, who is also a professional golfer, for his triumph. Since that interview, Rye has developed into a strong role model, not just for British Asians, but aspiring golfers from all backgrounds. Aaron had to recover from setbacks on the developmental circuits before earning his European Tour and PGA Tour cards, but the success eventually arrived with tournament wins on both sides of the Atlantic. Missing the cuts in his first two majors were experiences from which he learned, and after never finishing in the top 10 at one of the sport's four biggest tournaments, Aaron's hard graft has paid off spectacularly. "You won't find one person on the property who's not happy for him," said six-time major champion Rory McIlroy. Two-time major champion Xander Schauffele said, "Rarely do you feel like people work way harder than you. I've played a pretty good amount of time and Aaron is always there. He's always in the gym. He's always on the range. That's what it's about to be a major champion. You put the work in when nobody's looking." Aaron has finally been rewarded after a patient and precise performance at an attritional Aaronimink. Like the rest of the field, he had to take some punches from a course setup which wanted to inflict pain with its devilish pins, severely sloping greens and thick rough. But, as Rocky famously said, "It ain't about how hard you hit, it's about how hard you get hit and can keep moving forward." Aaron Rye is the proof.
Time now for a new numerical puzzle. Follow the clues and do the math to get the answer without the need to write anything down. Mina will reveal the clues and the all-important answer later in this edition. Best of luck.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. Here we go again. 6, 7, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8. Count, count, count up to 20. Count, 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 count up to 2 zeros. Count, count, count up to 20. Down, 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 here we go, 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 go!
Hello again, everyone. Well, this week, let's do another number quiz. Let's start off with the number of days in a leap year. Then, divide that number by 2. Multiply that answer by 10. Then add 70. Then add half of 90. And that should get you to this week's total, which should be the year that World War II ended.
Cheers for those questions. I'll get my mind working on them. Up now, however, is another block of local news. Now, you may not think it's plausible, what with all this unsettled weather of sunshine and showers around, but according to some meteorologists, the UK could be in for a prolonged hot and dry summer this year, as climate scientists predict that El Niño is just around the corner. The changing climate pattern, which some scientists are referring to as Super El Niño, is expected to bring a drastic change to weather patterns globally, supercharging extreme weather events and raising temperatures across the globe. While mainly affecting the tropical Pacific Ocean and its surrounding regions, that doesn't mean that the UK will remain unaffected, as the El Niño could increase the likelihood of higher temperatures over the summer period. But what does all of this mean to the West Midlands? What is a super El Niño? An El Niño occurs when the tropical Pacific naturally transitions between two warmer and cooler weather patterns, which are known as El Niño and La Niña. The cooler phase of the two, La Niña, has been present since December 2024 and usually sees a cooler global temperature as a result. However, El Niño is the opposite, and with it comes a chance for much drier and warmer spells of weather than normal. The World Meteorological Organization, WMO, previously predicted that El Niño will return this year as early as May or June. Talking of the weather change, Wilfred Mufumu Mokaya, Chief of Climate Prediction at the WMO, said, "After a period of neutral conditions at the start of the year, climate models are now strongly aligned, and there is high confidence in the onset of El Niño, followed by further intensification in the months that follow." Some meteorological groups predict that the upcoming El Niño could be particularly strong, with some now branding it a super El Niño. What does this mean for the West Midlands? El Niño is associated with the rising global temperatures, with 2024 still currently being registered as the hottest year on record, which occurred in the last El Niño phase. Despite being in the cooler period of the two, 2025 was still registered as among the warmest years on record in the UK, according to the Met Office. Last year saw a number of drought actions being enforced across the UK and the West Midlands, and reservoir levels falling significantly lower than average. During this period, Blythfield Reservoir dropped to 47.5%, while Titsworth Reservoir was reported at 56%, with water restrictions being urged across the region. Does this mean another drought for the region? Due to our distance from the Pacific, the impact of an El Niño is less predictable. However, the UK can be influenced indirectly by the global rise in temperature. Typically, an El Niño event brings warmer weather to the UK during summer and also increases our likelihood of experiencing colder temperatures during the winter period. Whilst the drought status in 2025 struck during the La Niña phase, it is unknown yet exactly how this El Niño will affect us directly.
And any fears of a drought stems from last year's period of dry weather in the West Midlands and wider country, with both Severn Trent and South Staffs Water putting drought measures into place to cope with lower reservoir levels. So, with the possibility of more water shortages in the near future, we ask South Staffs Water Director of Water Quality and Environment, Natalie Aykroyd, about the company's preparation for more drought conditions this year. She said, "Droughts are always a concern. Last year, our reservoir in Bluefield dropped to around 40%, which was the lowest ever recorded. But this year, we have had a really good head start. But we have had high rainfall over the winter period, and the reservoir is sitting at 100%. We have had a really good recovery from the drought, and the long-term impact of that is that we are 9% higher in water level than we normally are at this time of year." Ms. Aykroyd said that drought is a possibility every year, and while the future remains uncertain, the company is focused on ensuring the water keeps flowing. "There is always a potential for higher temperatures and drier spells," she said. "And while any future predictions are a bit uncertain, the Met Office has predicted a real chance for higher temperatures than normal, but also wetter weather. What we are focused on currently is keeping Bluefield as high as possible to make sure that we have enough water for both customers and the environment, and ensure that we have the best possible summer. No two droughts are the same. We have learned a lot of lessons from last year, but we are seeing a trend of drier and hotter summers, and the demand for water is increasing over the years. We are really getting as much on the front foot this year by conserving the water level as much as we can and reducing the amount of water we are taking. We have already started to take action months in advance. We look at that forecasting, soil moisture deficit, ground movement. A big part of this is raising customer awareness. South Staffordshire is actually classed as a water-stressed region, so it doesn't get the rainfall you would expect. We talk to customers about using water wisely and link that back to the impact on the environment. We don't just wait for droughts to happen, we plan for them and be as proactive as possible.
Next up, with the UK's living costs continuing to spiral, with thanks to Black Country Food Bank's Deputy CEO and Operations Manager Keely Jones, we introduce the final episode of an exclusive six-part series providing further insight into a lifeline service, from the initiatives and projects through to interviews with a team of volunteers. Introducing the final episode of Black Country Food Bank.
Yeah, so hi Katie, how are you?
Good, yeah.
Good. Thanks so much for meeting with me this morning. I thought it'd be really nice, so the project's been going for a year now, just for us to have a bit of a catch up and a time to reflect on how it's gone. So it was just over a year ago we approached Health Watch Dudley because we know how brilliant you are at engaging with communities, and we know how passionate you are about hearing people's voices and making change. And I suppose for us at Black Country Food Bank, we were really keen to find out about what is it really like for people accessing our food banks. So we wanted you to have those real conversations about what barriers people are facing, what challenges they're facing, and also like ideas that they have themselves about what would make things better for them. That might be things to do with our food bank, it might be around health and social care, it might be around lots of different things. And also we wanted to be able to give that additional signposting support in our food banks as well, so hence why we wanted to work with you guys. And I guess I'm interested to hear from you, what's it been like? So you've been here kind of week after week in our food banks talking to people. How have you found things?
It's been a little bit of a roller coaster, definitely. Some weeks I feel really good, really confident, positive, helping people. Other weeks it's a little bit more challenging. People come to food banks, sometimes they're in crisis. And sometimes there's a lot of complex problems that can't be solved, you know, over just one conversation. So that's something that I think I wasn't really expecting when we started this project. I think both of us thought that it would be, you know, me coming into the food banks, chatting with people, giving them a bit of information on how to sort of benefits, maybe information on getting a job or education and then sending them on their way.
Yeah.
And it hasn't quite been like that.
Mm.
I think there are a lot of issues that are wider mm-hmm. and more complex that mean that people are relying on food banks regularly.
Yeah, so you feel like the issues are much deeper rooted.
Definitely, yeah. I think it's been, it's really highlighted how a lot of people come to food banks. There's, it's not just one issue, it's a lot of issues that kind of intertwine.
Mm.
And sometimes that's where it's difficult for them to get support.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of services, they will only kind of address one issue at a time and will ignore anything else that's going on in a person's life. Mm. And life's not like that.
No, life's quite complicated, isn't it? And a lot of factors and challenges are intertwined. And and I suppose, has that been quite hard for you, sort of emotionally as well, as a worker coming in?
Yeah, it has been quite difficult. I think earlier this year I did really struggle with the really wanting to, I had a lot of frustration wanting to help people and feeling like I was stuck and that there was only so much I could do. A lot of people really come when they are in a crisis, they're going through some really difficult situations, and that's quite hard to hear and to take on. So that has been quite challenging.
Yeah.
It has definitely been balanced out when I get good feedback.
Yes.
People say that I've managed to help them, which is really good.
We've heard loads of like really positive things. And I was chatting to a lady here the other week who said like a massive difference you'd helped in terms of her housing situation. You'd helped her children get clothing and all sorts of things that she said she never would have known about how to go about unless she'd spoken to you. So I think there's definitely been lots of positives. And what other ways have you how have you helped people, and what sort of things have you signposted people to?
So it has been a real mix. The majority of the signposting I've done has been to financial services. I kind of have a little checklist of things that I go through with people. So one of the first things is checking that they've seen what benefits and grants they're entitled to, so making sure that people are getting what they really deserve.
Yes.
And then just making sure that they're getting the social support, the healthcare that they need. It is a real mix, actually. Yeah. There was one lady that I spoke to a few weeks ago, and she was really struggling at home, and I was able to help her contact occupational therapy. And somebody came around to her house. She's had a stair rail fitted, she's had some other equipment, and she said in 3 days everything's just got better.
That's
so
amazing.
That was really good to hear.
That's such a brilliant outcome, isn't it? And that'll make such a positive difference to that person's life as well. And we know like how important those essential things are before we can even then start to think about, you know, other things like employment and sort of, you know, health and well-being. So that's brilliant. And I guess for us, like, what's important is you guys will be compiling a report. You'll be putting in your recommendations. You've spoken to people in food banks about what they think could help make things better going forward. And we're going to use that information to shape our strategy. So our strategy won't just be words on a page. It will be actual physical changes that we make. It will be new projects that we deliver. So we're really keen to hear those recommendations and that report. And I suppose from a Health Watch perspective, what will you be doing in terms of taking that further?
Yeah, so when I was speaking to people, we found that a lot of people were struggling to access healthcare.
Yeah.
A lot of people struggling to access mental health support and also accessing primary care. On a number of occasions, I used my phone to call and book someone a dentist appointment or help them order prescriptions.
Yeah.
Just people not having access to a mobile phone or data.
Yes.
That's something that a lot of services don't always think about, consider. So that's something that we're really going to be pushing, that, you know, not relying on digital access, making sure that everyone can access the care that they need. Yeah.
That's great. And I think what's so powerful is so much learning that has come from the project, and we've got the routes now and the places we can take it. I know Health Watch sit on various boards, and so do we, and there are places that we can now take this information to sort of try and influence change locally as well.
Yeah, so I think the people that sit on these boards, the leaders in health and social care, they see a lot of numbers all of the time, but they don't always hear these real stories and the impact on people in our community. One thing that we'll definitely be trying to highlight is the mental health support and how a lot of people that I see that are struggling with their mental health or in crisis, they're dealing with other issues as well. It might be addiction, it might be financial issues, it might be physical health as well.
Yeah.
And often when they're dealing with something else, the mental health support is then not provided.
Yeah.
So it leaves people in a limbo.
Yeah.
And I think that's something we really want to get across, that people aren't ever just one issue.
Yeah.
You know, people are dealing with multiple issues.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So it's definitely been a worthwhile project from our perspective. And yeah, just wanted to say a massive thank you really for working with us this past year, and we're really excited to get the report, because it's the first time we've had kind of real hard hitting information and feedback from people in our food banks.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of it is down to the volunteers being so welcoming and really also just helping, you know, make those introductions. Sometimes it's a lot asking someone to just come up and, you know, talk to me about any and all problems they may be facing, to see if I can possibly help. But also, you know, the people that use food banks, they've been really open, really had some insightful ideas about, you know, how we can address issues.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, thank you very much. And yeah, look forward to kind of seeing how we can take it forward and hopefully see some changes start to happen from our perspective, but also more widely.
Yeah, really feeling positive about
brilliant. Thanks, Katie.
Next up, we have another block of local news.
Six towns in our region are in the running to become Britain's first town of culture after the deadline for initial bids closed. Expressions of interest have been submitted on behalf of Bilston, Briley Hill, Dudley, Smethwick, Stafford, and Stourbridge in the first round of the bidding process to find the Town of Culture 2028. The competition was announced by Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy late last year, initially to celebrate small and medium-sized towns across the UK, although the criteria was later expanded to allow larger towns to also take part. The winning town will host a year-long cultural programme in 2028 and receive a £3 million prize. Initial expressions of interest had to be submitted, and a shortlist of towns will be announced in some time during the spring. Each shortlisted town will receive £60,000 to develop a more comprehensive bid, and the final winner will be announced in early 2027. The six towns in the Black Country and Mid-Staffordshire to lodge applications are Bilston. The town, which was built on its steel-making and coal-mining industry, is famed for its enamelware and rich industrial heritage. It is also the birthplace of glam rock band Slade, which met at the town's Drill Hall and home to the famous Trumpet Jazz Bar. Councillor Stephen Simkins, ward councillor and leader of Wolverhampton Council, said the town's identity had been shaped by creativity, the arts, heritage, and community spirit. Councillor Chris Burden, cabinet member for City Development, said, "The town's heritage gives its people an enduring strength that sees them celebrate their past, while their resourcefulness, warmth, and determination enable them to embrace the future, making Bilston an excellent candidate to maximise the benefits of being the first UK town of culture." He said the town already had a strong cultural identity thanks to venues and organisations such as Bilston Craft Gallery, Bilston Town Hall, and the Robin and Gazebo Theatre, the new multi-million pound outdoor market, due to be completed in June, would also provide a dedicated space for events, bringing the community and visitors together. Smethwick. Manufacturing heritage is also at the heart of Sandwell Council's bid for Smethwick to become Town of Culture. Councillor Kerry Carmichael, leader of Sandwell Council, described the town as being an economic powerhouse during the time of the Industrial Revolution. "If it can be made, it's been made in Smethwick," she said. "It is home to Galton Bridge, the highest canal bridge in the world, and also the former Chance Glassworks, once one of the world's leading manufacturers of glass. Its Ruskin Pottery Works was also known around the world for its colourful designs, which formed part of the arts and crafts movement." Councillor Carmichael said, "Smethwick is a uniquely diverse town within Sandwell that prides itself on its hyper-local creative vibrancy and its community-driven spirit. With a high density of creatives from artists, musicians, designers working and living in areas like Bearwood, Smethwick is a catalyst for creative and cultural industries innovating for the next generation." Stafford. With an 11th century castle providing an ideal backdrop for outdoor performances and cultural events, and 16th century ancient high house being the largest timber-framed house in England, Stafford already brings plenty of cultural capital with its bid. But Richard Stone, the man who is leading the campaign, says the real focus will be on how Stafford would use Town of Culture status to benefit the area. "It is not just about the culture we have got, but about looking to the future, about how we would use Town of Culture to get to where we would like to be." He said a group of more than 40 cultural organisations were behind the application, which would include a major festival called Stafford Town of Love. This will be broken down into different cultural streams, for example, Stafford Loves Theatre, Stafford Loves Arts and Crafts, or for the younger audiences, Stafford Loves Gaming, said Mr. Stone. He said events such as Stafford Pride had shown how much affection people felt towards the town, and the potential it had in holding major cultural events. Dudley. Known as the capital of the Black Country, Dudley is home to Dudley Zoo and Castle, the Black Country Living Museum, and Dudley Canal and Caverns, as well as the 12th century St. James's Priory. Wren's Nest National Nature Reserve is world famous geologically for its well-preserved Silurian coral reef fossils, including the legendary Dudley Bug Trilobite. And Dudley Canal and Cavern Trust has plans to reopen the Seven Sisters Limestone Caves to the public for the first time since 1967. Bumble Hole Nature Reserve in Netherton is also home to a popular annual boating festival. A bid would likely also include reference to the town's heritage as the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. Dud Dudley became the first person in the world to be granted a patent to smelt iron with charcoal in 1622, and his great-great-grandnephew Abraham Darby, also born in Dudley, became the first ironmaster to make the process commercially viable. Thomas Newcomen is also credited with building the first commercially viable steam engine in the area, although it is not yet clear which sites will fall within the boundaries of the bid area. Famous sons and daughters of Dudley include Frankenstein film director James Whale, comedians Billy Dainty, Sir Lenny Henry, and Norman Pace, broadcaster Sue Lawley, and footballers Duncan Edwards and Sam Allardyce. Stourbridge. Stourbridge has been at the heart of Britain's glassmaking industry since the early 1600s, following the immigration of French coal miners in the Huguenot diaspora. The Stourbridge Lion, the first locomotive to run on rails in the US, was built at Foster and Rastrick Works in Wollaston. Dudley Council, which has submitted three separate bids, said the town's independent arts community would also play an important role in the town's bid, and Stourbridge is also home to the Lace Guild, Britain's largest museum of lace making. Stourbridge was also at the heart of the 1990s indie music scene thanks to groups such as Pop Will Eat Itself and Ned's Atomic Dustbin, while King Edward VI Grammar School, now King Edward VI College, educated luminaries such as Samuel Johnson, actor David Garrick, Robert Plant, and computer pioneer Sir Maurice Wilkes. Film star Sir Cedric Hardwick also grew up in Lye. Briley Hill. In its heyday, Briley Hill was one of the biggest producers of iron and steel in the world, with thousands employed at the Earl of Dudley's Round Oak Ironworks. Today, the site is occupied by the Waterfront Leisure Park, which will be well placed to host some activities. Briley Hill, like Stourbridge and Dudley, has a long-standing history as a glassmaking centre, and the council has indicated that the town's emerging community-driven creative scene will form a major part of the application.
And Briley Hill has another giant reason for consideration too. It's been more than 9 decades since George Lovett passed away, but in Briley Hill, his story still feels very much alive. Known locally as the Briley Hill Giant, George wasn't just famous for his extraordinary size. He was remembered just as much for his humour, his character, and the way he stayed connected to the world, even when he could no longer step outside his front door. Now, local historian Sarah Hayward is bringing his story back into the spotlight and urging people not to forget the man behind the legend. Today, George Lovett rests at St. Michael's Church in Briley Hill, and Sarah points out you can spot his grave due to it being substantially wider than the ones around it. Standing at over 7 feet tall and weighing at one point a reported 48 stone, George Lovett was widely believed to be Britain's heaviest man at the time of his death in March 1933. Newspaper reports across his lifetime tracked his weight as it climbed, 38 stone, 40 stone, and eventually close to that staggering final figure. His shoulders stretched nearly 3 feet 8 inches across, with a neck measuring more than 30 inches. But George himself took it all in stride. When asked about his size, he famously joked, "I must follow my mother, who was 22 stone." That sense of humour stayed with him throughout his life. George lived much of his life in Briley Hill, working hard in the local iron industry as a chain striker at Round Oak Ironworks and later at Wright's Chain Works in Cradley Heath. He left school at 12, having already reached the expected standard, something Sarah Hayward notes as a sign of his intelligence. But life took a turn after a serious accident. A fall from a hayloft left him with 2 fractured legs. Combined with his increasing weight, it left him unable to walk. For the final 12 years of his life, George never left his home. Still, he didn't disappear from the community. He would sit by his open window, chatting with friends and neighbours passing by. His presence remained part of daily life in the town. Over the years, stories about George spread far beyond Briley Hill, some funny, some hard to believe, all unforgettable. There was the theatre trip in London, where he couldn't fit into a seat and calmly sat in the gangway instead. The taxi ride, where, according to reports, the vehicle simply couldn't carry his weight and the bottom dropped out. The tram journeys, where passengers had to shift to the other side to balance the carriage. And even a trip to a fair, where his weight reportedly broke the wheel of the trap carrying him. Whether every detail was exact or not, the stories all point to the same thing. George left an impression. During the war, George was summoned for a medical examination. At the time, he weighed around 38 stone and was already unable to walk. His response became one of the most quoted lines. If they wanted him, they ought to fetch him. It's a moment that perfectly captures both his situation and his wit. Burying George. When George died at home on March 12, 1933, aged somewhere between 63 and 65, depending on reports, the scale of the challenge became clear. Newspaper archives found by Sarah Hayward tell the story of Mr. George Lovett of Briley Hill. His coffin had to be specially made, over 7 foot long and more than 3 foot wide, described at the time as the largest ever made in the country. To remove him from the house, workers had to take out the windows and part of the structure. His body was moved using planks, rollers, pulleys and sheer manpower. Even the funeral procession had to be adapted. A traditional hearse wasn't practical, so his own coal cart was used instead. Thousands lined the streets. Crowds were so dense at the church that gates had to be locked, with people climbing walls and rooftops just to catch a glimpse. It was, as newspapers described, a sight unique in local history. A news article was written by the Dudley Chronicle on the day of the funeral. It reported, "Thousands of people lined the route of the funeral procession to the parish church, a distance of just over half a mile. And so dense was the crowd outside the entrance of the church, it was deemed wise to lock the gates against the people. Only those actually concerned with the funeral were allowed in. Hundreds of people, however, overcome this obstacle by climbing the nearby walls and climbing onto roofs of houses. Several hundred people also had an uninterrupted, although rather distant, view from Marsh Park. Very many people came from adjacent towns, some people from Birmingham, Worcestershire, West Bromwich and Wolverhampton, to witness what was said to be a sight to be unique in local history. Despite the headlines and the spectacle, those who knew George remembered something else. He was kind. He was sociable. He had a surprisingly soft voice and he was well liked. Furniture had to be specially made for him, a huge chair and an oversized bed, but he never let his situation define his spirit. Even when housebound, he stayed part of the community. And that's what Sarah Haywood wants people to remember. Not just the measurements, not just the records, but the man. Remembering George in 2026. Today, George Lovett rests at St. Michael's Church in Briley Hill. His title as Britain's heaviest man may have passed on, but his place in local history hasn't. Sarah Haywood hopes that by sharing his story again through old newspaper archives and photographs, a new generation will come to know him. Because after 93 years, George Lovett is still being talked about, still being remembered, and still, in many ways, part of the town he never really left. Up now we have to hear what the weather has in store for us. Brought to us, come rain or shine, by our own sunny Mina.
Hi everyone, it's Mina here with your forecast for the week ahead. And after a cold and wet few days, sunscreen, sun hats and sunglasses at the ready. As it's looking like UV levels are going to be high, as we are set to have a bank holiday glowing in some glorious early summer sunshine, with sunrise and sunset times as follows: 5 a.m. for the sunrise and 9:10 p.m. for the sunset. As for the weather, Friday 22nd of May is set to see widespread sunshine across the region, with a moderate breeze driving in warm air from the south. Temperatures shall be very pleasant with highs of 23 degrees. Moving into the weekend, and the weather shall continue to be dominated by some delightful prolonged spells of sunshine. It's been a while since we have been able to say that. With much gentler breeze than Friday, temperatures shall begin to feel a touch warmer too, with highs of 25 or even 26 degrees across the region. And this is how it shall remain as we move into Bank Holiday Monday and into next week, with unbroken sunshine expected throughout the day on Monday and Tuesday 26th of May. But as we know, all good things must come to an end, and with a change to more northwesterly breeze on Wednesday, a cooler weather system shall bring in a return of unsettled weather to close out the week, with light rain and drizzle throughout Wednesday 27th and Thursday 28th of May, and a gentle breeze keeping temperatures settled of 20 degrees, offering some welcome relief for our gardens. So, there we have it. It looks like it's plenty of sunshine to enjoy this week. Please do take care and remember, if you are out and about, to take the necessary precautions to protect yourself from the sun. Should you need any further guidance or support with how to best protect your eyes, you can contact Pete, Sat and Cushy, Beacon's team of sight loss advisors, on 01902 880111. Do take care, have a wonderful week, and enjoy the weather.
Now, here come the quiz
answers,
and they're brought to us by Mina.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8. Count up to 20. Count up to 2, 0. Count up to 20. Down, here we go. Go.
Hello, and here are your answers for another number puzzle challenge. Feeling confident? Have you got the correct answer? Let's see. Roger began by asking us how many days there are in a leap year, the answer to which is 366. So 366 days in a leap year. Roger then took us on a mathematical journey of division, multiplication and addition, starting with dividing the number we had, 366, by 2. This gave us 183. We then had to multiply our number by 10, taking us to 1,830. Add 70, which ticked us up to 1,900. And a little tricky tester to finish, which was to add half of 90 to our number. So half of 90 is 45, added to our number of 1,900, gave us a final answer for this week's number puzzle challenge of 1,945, the year in which World War II ended. So, how did you do? Did you get it right? If not, not to worry, as I will be back next week to test you all again. Bye for now.
Now then, with thanks to TNF Soundings, we introduce episode 2 of a 3-part story set on the Norfolk Broads about a visually impaired military veteran called Kathy, who, in this story, finds herself solving a mystery alongside ex-Scotland Yard detective Jack Fellows, a river ranger. The story has been written especially for TNF Soundings, and the author has given permission for the Talking News to use it copyright-free. It is written by published author Chris Crowther, who has written 9 full-length Jack Fellows novels, and it is read for you by TNF Soundings contributor Amanda. Introducing episode 2 of Beyond the Call.
Jack was thankful for next afternoon's enduring sunshine as the Waveney carried his patrol launch upriver between the riverside dwellings and boatyards of St. Olaf's. True to his promise, he'd called his old contact at Scotland Yard and requested any information they had on Major Bertie Barraclough. Having received a reply that same evening, he then called Kathy, been told the flotilla was night stopping at St. Olaf's, and arranged to rendezvous there the next day. And so here he was, with the tall masts of the sailboats easy to spot, amongst several other hire craft, moored beside a working boatyard. He looked for Vixen and spotted the cruiser lying several boats away, with Barraclough sitting on his cabin roof, droning on to a young couple standing patiently listening on the quay below. On the sailboats, only Cathy could be seen, busying herself in Sunburst's cockpit. Jack swung his launch into the tide and was soon alongside. "Good to see you again," greeted Cathy, smiling as she made fast the launch's lines. "Come aboard."
"What happened to the others?"
asked Jack, once he'd joined her in Sunburst's cockpit. "Off exploring the village's old Augustinian priory, leaving me to brush up on my splicing." She picked up a length of 3-strand rope with an ice splice worked into one end. "My next lesson for the girls."
"All good stuff."
Jack glanced 200 yards down the quay to where Vixen lay moored adjacent to the boatyard's open work area. Here several boats were laid up ashore, supported by wooden props and chocks, and providing tempting hidey-holes for a little girl and 2 small boys, happily playing hide-and-seek in between them. Jack guessed them to be the offspring of the couple still being lectured by the voluble Barraclough. He turned back to Cathy.
"I see our Major Bertie has found a new audience for his tales."
"Yes, poor them," agreed Cathy with a little chuckle. He arrived too late yesterday to moor next to us and had to settle for that slot further down."
She paused and frowned.
"But you said your inquiries had produced results, Jack. Anything we should know?"
"I think so. The fact is that..."
But Jack was suddenly stopped mid-sentence by a piercing scream from further down the quay. It came from the yard's laid-up boats, one of which was now heeled over at a perilous angle, as 2 small boys scrambled from beneath. That left the little girl, probably still there, and somehow trapped. Jack grabbed Cathy by the shoulder.
"There's been an accident. Come on, we may need your medical skills."
Helping her ashore, they both ran down the quay, Cathy holding Jack's shoulder for guidance. Fast as they ran, however, Jack could see that they had been beaten to the scene by no other than Bertie Barraclough. While the young parents stood frozen with shock, he had leapt from atop his cabin and sprinted straight to the listing boat, with its 1 remaining support already splintering under the strain. Without hesitation, Bertie dived headlong beneath to wedge his broad shoulders under the turn of its bilge, adding not only support, but even raising the boat just enough for the little girl to free herself.
"Get out!"
yelled Bertie as the remaining prop creaked and splintered some more. The girl scuttled free, but even as she did, there came an even more ominous crack from the remaining prop as it gave way completely and the boat rolled onto its beam ends with a force beyond even Bertie's strength.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. Thank you for listening. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us. Stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!